The Oddcast.
Two guys yelling at each other about radio, music, and nonsense. And now, here's Max Tolkoff and Halloran.
So, Halloran, this week, if you want, you can just lay back and relax.
Thank
you don't
God.
Have to say all that much.
I don't
because,
have to say anything.
No, you know why?
Because we have a fucking legend.
No, it's not that. It's that me and the legend are going to be talking about radio.
Good.
So
I fucking can't wait.
I'm
just going to sit in the background.
You can just sit in the background
all right.
and fuck off.
Who is this fucking legend that we have on this
all right,
week?
So today, it's an honor for us to have Nick Harcourt on the podcast.
Fuck you. You got Nick Harcourt? There's no fucking way you got
Nick Harcourt. He returned my call. I can't believe it. It's fucking incredible that he actually took my call to begin with.
You know, somebody has to, right?
Nick, if the five people that listen, by the way, this is a podcast for the
big audience.
The people we know in the industry, which is five people.
Yeah. They're all listening.
I first met Nick when he was at WDST in Woodstock many, many, many moons ago.
That was a while back.
I don't know what you were doing before then. That's the only part I don't have is what were you doing before DST in Woodstock? Where did you come from?
He was learning how to use mic technique. That's what he was using.
Oh, okay. Something I do not know
there
anything
you go.
About.
You're back on the mic.
No, all right, thank you very
you're
much.
You're going like this. Hey, Nick, what are you doing over there?
Every
I'm
fucking
just
going to
give you shit.
Every week
shit every
he just
week.
Gives me shit about mic. It's like I can't do it well enough for him.
So I, you're doing great right now, by
thank
the way.
You.
Well
thank
done.
You. Yeah,
I've scrubbed everything. The first 30 years of my life are a secret.
Oh, so you have no history before DST?
No, I didn't.
And
exist.
That's fine.
This is what I can tell you. Alfreton. We're in Nottingham, which it's in the Midlands. I know that.
Be careful now. Really, because if there's somebody listening from those towns, first of all, you got it right. It's Nottingham. Well done.
Nottingham. I remember this because we share some DNA.
Not Nottingham.
Nottingham. He's from knots. He's tied up in knots.
I'm from Birmingham.
Well, it's like all those
Birmingham.
Boston cities. You can't say Worcester. See, but, it's Worcester
Birmingham.
And Leominster.
Let me explain one thing to you.
Leominster.
I don't. Worcester. I forgot he was from Birmingham because he does not have a Brummy accent. He
I don't.
Really, he has a
I
very.
Don't. But I can.
Like
I
King
can.
Henry VIII. Which,
if you want
which
me
school?
To, I can do a Birmingham accent. You're right, are you?
Is that a Birmingham accent?
How you
it
doing?
Is?
How you doing? Max, Mike, all right?
Yeah, right.
All right, how you
right,
doing?
Right, Tez.
Up the villa.
All right, so what is your accent? And what your normal speaking voice, and where do we identify
he's
where
he's educated,
you're from?
That's the difference.
I'm actually that's not. Right. I left school at 16, if that counts. I got out very early, because, you know.
Why not?
You weren't learning anything.
Why stick yeah. around for that crap? An English education in the 70s. I got out really early.
It
I was
better than it was over here, though.
No, I think
it
that,
was.
No, this yes, better
his
than it
education
was, over here.
Was
yes.
better than it was over here. He knew more,
of course.
So,
yeah.
so you left at school at 16. Did you get O levels?
I did. I think I got two or maybe three.
That's not bad.
It's
art. Art.
You're supposed to get
geography.
Seven, I think, for it to mean
I got
something.
Nine, lovey.
Oh my gosh! Well, look, you're very smart. Very
all right,
clever.
But no A levels.
I got English language.
Yeah.
Thank God.
That's worth applauding because
I got religious education.
So, interesting.
Silence
so,
on that
so,
one.
So I can
R-E.
I can take anybody on the Synoptic Gospels, and
that's actually quite impressive.
Well,
three
of them are written by the same guy. We know that. And ceramics.
I did ceramics too. I did art.
Let me ask you a question.
Ceramics
were you
was my
religious
favorite.
At the time?
Was I religious?
At the time that
no,
you were learning
I'll,
all this?
I'll,
did
I'll,
you become
I'll,
religious afterwards? Or was it just like just an educational course?
Well, you can tell, obviously, I'm a believer.
Yes,
but,
of course.
I was cheating on some exams. At the end of the fourth year of our version of high school, you had to pick some subjects. You had to drop some subjects and pick the ones that you wanted to do for O-level. And my favorite subject was history, right? And I didn't do very well in the exam. And I had cheated on the RE exam. And they were like, you can't do history. You need to be doing RE because you're really good at that.
What's RE?
What? Religious education. Or yeah. RI, religious instruction. One
yeah.
or the other. So anyway, so yeah, those are my O-levels, and I was out of school at 16.
Is that because when you were doing history, you kept saying, Jesus Christ, I can't study this. And you kept taking the Lord's name in vain, so they said, you need to go to religious instruction.
Yes.
Sure.
Is that right?
Ironically
yeah.
enough, history in England is quite freaking intense because they actually have history there.
Right, now,
you know what I mean?
I understand, but
a little bit.
Let's not talk about English history now, because you'll start talking about it, and it'll go for an hour and a half.
First of all, I'm dead impressed that, first of all, he was great at history, but he was, you know, he bollocked up his RE by cheating.
I know.
What was the name of the priest? Don't tell me the name of the priest. Tell me the name of the defrocked person that taught you. Your religious education.
Nick, yeah. Show us the place where he touched you. So anyway, so eventually you come to this country, you go to DST. How long were you at DST before you bailed out of that place? It was a lot of years, right?
So here's the good news for me, anyway. I had the very good fortune to, once I sort of did my detour between the age of 16 and 30, which included a few years in Australia, I arrived in upstate New York in September of 1988. To visit a friend who I'd known back home in Lichfield in England, which is just outside of Birmingham, who was in a band and was working with a guy called Jerry Marotta, who some of you may know, the drummer.
Drummer extraordinaire.
Who at that time was Peter Gabriel's drummer. And my friend from Lichfield had got a deal for a second, and they sent him over to the States to work with Jerry. Anyway, the deal never happened, and that's his story. But I ended up going to look, really. I was just sort of like, let's go to Woodstock. That sounds like a great place to get messed up, right?
Right.
Didn't they have a festival there or something? Of course, as you probably know, the festival was nowhere near Woodstock ever.
Yeah, exactly.
But I ended up in Woodstock. It was a cool little town in the Catskills. And two marvelous things happened. First of all, I got sober for the first time. Which was something that really needed to happen.
And by the way, let me just say as an American, very hard to do in upstate New York, because upstate New York is all about drinking, especially during the winter.
That's why I went.
Right?
And a funny thing happened on the way to Woodstock, as they say. And I ended up getting sober. And then secondly, I stayed for a while because I met a bird, as you do. And then miraculously, I went down to the local radio station, which was a cool sort of block program station at the time. They had, you know, like book readings on the air in the morning and classical music at the weekend. But they had like cool, what I think they called at the time, modern rock music in the afternoons. And I went and knocked on the door. It was in a house on the main street there in town, Tinker Street. And I went and knocked on the door. I said, hey, I just got here from Australia. And I've got this great Australian music with me that hadn't broken here at the time. Bands like In Excess and Crowded House and, you know, Midnight Oil, stuff like that. They were just beginning to sort of make some inroads here and a bunch of others that didn't. Would you give me an Australian show? Long story short, I never got the Australian show. But what they did do was say, well, we're going to need to. The first thing they said is, do you have a social security number? I was like, what's that? Said, well, you can't work without one of those. And I was like,
what about a license? Did you need a third operator license?
You did need a license. Yeah, but you just, you know, filled in a piece of cardboard and they stamped it and sent it back. A radio operator's license,
yes,
you're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah, I still have it somewhere. But they said, well, we'll tell you what we'll do. We will sponsor you to work here as a part-timer. So they sent all the paperwork in to sponsor me, and they denied it. Let's put it that way. And without giving away too much, I married my girlfriend, and once I got a work permit, then I started working there as a part-timer. And initially, so this is like 1989, and initially it was doing overnight fill-ins, and through a variety of circumstances and really just sticking
Wait,
around.
Wait, they had an overnight shift at DST?
They did.
Tiny little station like that? Well, overnight shift.
This is 1988.
Yeah, they still had overnight shifts. Yeah.
Of course, they didn't turn the transmitter off because there's nobody there to run it.
When I got to 91X in 83, there were no jocks after midnight.
Wow.
And they're just Mexican operators running
Well,
carts.
There was somebody in the room.
There was somebody in the room
running
carts.
Because there was no automation.
Right.
So he was the automation.
We actually had a guy on the air there who was, you know, in the mid-Hudson Valley, was very well known as an overnight guy. He's a guy called Mark Zip. And he used to do the overnight show, and he used to do the coolest music mix. And I'll be real honest with you, he taught me how to do radio. I mean, I sat in with him, and he taught me how to work the board and, you know, how to do segues. And you know, up until then, I was just a fan. And this guy was very gracious in teaching me how to,
Where is he
how
now?
To do it. I have no idea. I have no idea.
It's always that way with our mentors, our influencers.
While he's talking about radio for a second, can I ask him a question?
He buys and sells records, like vinyl.
That would make sense.
And, you know, buys collections.
So, but you had an education for radio with Peel, right? You listened to Radio Luxembourg.
I grew up listening to Radio Luxembourg and Radio Caroline, which was the pirate station.
Right. So you knew how good radio was supposed to sound, right?
Let's see if he really did listen to radio. You remember Big Bad Al?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's not Radio Caroline. There's another pirate station in the Netherlands.
Me. Yeah.
No, that I met at the. It's a long story, but anyway, one of their guys came to visit us in San Diego to dry out because he was always drinking.
You know, most of the Caroline guys ended up on BBC when they started Radio 1 because at that time when Caroline was doing its thing and Radio Luxembourg as well, which was another cool place, I think they used to share a signal for a while. It was Luxembourg during the day and then maybe Caroline, you know, overnight. I'm not sure. But the guys from Caroline ended up being hired when the BBC started Radio 1, a lot of those guys, because up until then, the BBC didn't have any pop music on the radio until like the early 60s.
Did you see that movie by the guy that did?
I did.
What's das it called? Boot.
Can't remember it.
Das Boot. Yeah, it's the pirate ship
out there. Yeah.
That was so great. Das Boot. To go underwater.
We should look it up.
I know. But you don't remember the pirate station, the Dutch pirate station that, I got to remember. I can't remember.
But Luxembourg and Caroline were what I listened to as a kid.
And John Peel went, because obviously you were living in England in the 70s when John took, he was doing the late night Radio 1 stuff.
So when I started really sort of getting interested in music, which was probably like, you know, 70, 71 or something like that, age 13, you know, up until then, it had just been whatever the parents were playing. And, you know, it's hard for people to realize that at the time, you know, you didn't really have a lot of places where you could source music. It was, you know, Radio 1 or the pirate stations or nothing. But when those guys came on board at Radio 1, and guys like John Peel, Johnny Walker, and a few other guys who I can't remember right now, Peel was the guy who was doing all the cool sessions. And that was where I first heard T-Rex.
Right.
That was where I first heard Led Zeppelin. Was where I first heard a lot of stuff, and of course, you know, he's a legend, and he's gone, unfortunately. But
there's always the bad guys like Tony Blackburn, Kenny Everett, and all those.
Well, Kenny Everett was a lot of fun. I mean,
I'm talking about like the guys who were not the musical. Peel was just a dude who he kind of like you. He got a job in the U.S. first because he was English.
He was in D.C., right?
In Texas, he worked on the Texas station because he was from Liverpool originally. He's a Liverpudlian originally. Scouse. So he gets a job on a Texas radio station because they go, oh, you must know something about the Beatles. So they put him on the early 60s in Texas. Then when he went back, he got his the other training that he did in, I think, one of the pirate stations. I don't remember which one it was. But then he obviously got to the BBC. But he was the most non-radio guy that I ever met.
He was. And he was the guy who was putting bands on that nobody had ever heard of. And, you know, let's be honest with him. Not all of them were great. But, you know, it's like freeform radio in general. You know, if you have enough... shots at bat, is that what you call it?
Yeah.
Then you're going to hit a couple out of the park. Do you like my baseball analogies?
I love it. Yeah. Well, you know more about baseball than I do.
If you have good innings, we'll do some cricket for you.
Cricket.
English radio has always fascinated me because there's no real format there, right? Because
there is now.
Now there is, but everybody used to listen to The Cure and whatever else there was on the pop side, right? In other words, these stations appealed to everybody. They didn't play... one genre or another.
Right. Well, they kind of did, actually, because Radio 1 really was the stuff that was focusing on the music that was happening now, the new pop music or whatever. The one great thing about English radio, though, is that pop music encompasses everything.
That's what I meant to say.
That's the good news, and that's kind of what I missed, to be honest with you. But, you know, Radio 1 has become very young and ultra sort of, you know, what is considered pop music today focused. And then Radio 2, which has now become probably the closest to the music that you guys and I listen to and program. It's more of a sort of AAA mix. And a lot of the guys who were on Radio 1 back in the day who got kicked off for being too old are now programming shows over at Radio 2. Yeah. But then they've also got Radio 6, which is a digital station that is the place that is really playing all the cool stuff.
And so that's where John Peel's kid is on 6 now.
Really? And how can you listen to them? Just it's online.
It's all online.
All online, yeah. The thing that Nick was pointing out is when they played the pop charts, it didn't matter what format it was from. You could have Gregorian chants on at number 2 that would get played right next to ABBA. Because ABBA was at number 1 because it was selling. So whatever sold. So when artists like Judge Dredd, who never got played on the radio, who was basically this guy who was doing fake reggae, singing bad nursery rhymes over the top of reggae. He was number one constantly. You remember this? Like Judge Dredd something. What was the name of that song that he used to release? Number six, number seven, number eight.
I got a feeling it was after I left.
No. It was. The problem was it never got played 70s. On the radio. Well, all throughout the 70s.
Well, the one thing that they used to have that I loved, and it was a part of my my upbringing as a fan of music, was two main things every week. It was the top 40 countdown, which was on a Sunday night. And they would play whatever was in the top 40 unless it was banned. So like when the Sex Pistols were in the top 40, we didn't get to hear that. But they would play the top 40 songs on the charts, whatever they were, wherever they came from, unless there was, as I said, every now and then they didn't, you know, wouldn't play something.
Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Oh, totally. Yeah. That wasn't played?
No. Relax wasn't. Actually, it was played for 2 weeks until somebody says, you know, he says, come.
Yeah. I was in Australia when that came out. But yeah, so top 40 radio, and that which was completely different from what top 40 radio is here. And
I have a question for you.
And then just to finish, Top of the Pops, which was the television show that was on every Thursday night at 7:30. And if you were a kid in the 70s, you were glued to the TV set watching Top of the Pops every week.
The song Lamb Lies Down on Broadway from Genesis, how big a hit was this in England?
Wasn't.
Yeah, not that I remember.
Thank you. Yeah. This, you know, okay, quick side note.
We'll get that other English
Steve
guy.
Steve West, our English guy,
yeah,
swore to me we should be playing Lamb Lies Down on Broadway at 91X because it was a big hit in England. And I said, first of all, nobody knows that here, and I don't believe you.
Never was.
It never was?
I saw that tour.
I don't know. I'm not sure that they had any... which era? Who was singing in Genesis?
That was the last album with Peter Gabriel.
The last one with Gabriel? Yeah. I don't think they had any hits with Gabriel.
They had none.
Did they?
With Peter Gabriel.
So, you know, the long and short of it is, you are the new John Peel. You're kind of a cross between him and this Zane Lowe guy who everybody is all bent out of shape about. I think you're that guy
now. Don't insult him with the Zane Lowe, please.
Why? I know. That's what I'm saying. Why does...
He's the Peel... Not the Zane Lowe. Zane Lowe is radically different in a completely different
way. They gave him a job on this Beats Radio 1 thing, and then nobody cares about it. Nobody's heard of it since. Does anybody listen? Does anybody care?
You know, I think the fair thing to say about Zane is that, you know, he did a really great job on Radio 1 when he was over there. And he was a very, very important DJ at the time. His presentation is very top 40, I think, you know, as opposed to John Peel, which is completely different, very laid back. You know, I have had the compliment paid to me over the years, you're kind of like the California John Peel. That doesn't sit that well with me, to be perfectly honest.
You know why? Because he's only talking about one state. You're the United States John Peel. You're our national John Peel.
But the thing about John Peel is John Peel was John Peel. And
that's
it. I'm a fan. I was influenced by his the way he did radio, I guess. But and then Zane is Zane. I would agree with you, though. You know, he got this great gig over at Beats. And I'm not sure how many people are listening to that.
Nobody's listening. Listen, the thing that you had that John Peel nor Zane Lowe ever had, neither of them were the voice of Land Rover. So F them, is what I say. And we'll get to that in a minute. But anyway, so you stuck around New York for a while, not getting drunk. And then
Woodstock,
how did you wind up in L.A. from Woodstock, New York? That is a fascinating maneuver. That's like... When you were doing the map of people moves, you know, did we do in that year that Nick went from?
What year did you jump from Woodstock to here?
98. So here's what happened. So I get on the air at DST in 89. I had the very good fortune to learn my craft and to be taught by people who, you know, knew what they were doing. And musically, I was a little bit different from most of the people there, but I was around right as modern rock was becoming alternative rock in the early 90s. And through attrition and being prepared to work for minimum wage, I stuck around long enough to I was the news director for 6 months, I think. Rip and read in the old days. You'd get the news on a telex or something. And then I got the morning show. And then I got the music director's gig. And then I got the PD gig. So by the middle of 97 or something like that, I was running the place.
Because Chet Five loved you.
Oh, well done. Yeah.
Five is the owner of the station. That's what he called himself.
It's a guy called Gary Chetkoff who had a partnership with four other guys. So that's why they called it Chet Five. Gary and I, we parted ways when I came to LA, and it was very, very simple. he kind of tortured me, you know, as the PD there.
Really?
Yeah, it was one of those things where you're working for somebody and, yes. And they know that you're doing the job, but they just want to just make sure that you know that they're the boss, you know? Yeah. And there was a day came when my midday person quit. I said, thank God, because she'd been, you know, difficult. And he, I'm being very polite now. And he said, we have to keep her at all costs. And I said, no, this is great. And he said, no, I'm pulling rank on you. We're going to keep her. And within a week or so of that, somebody had called me from Los Angeles and said, quite, you know, by happenstance, not connected in any way, and said, hey, there's this gig over in LA and you should apply for it because they've been looking for someone for 6 months.
Well, what was the gig? Was it a morning show gig? They're actually looking to fill a shift?
It was the shift at Morning Becomes Eclectic at KCRW. So
was it called that at that time or no?
Yeah.
It was called that.
Yeah, it's been called that for a long time.
Yeah.
A couple of people had it before I did. And they said, you should apply for this gig because they've been looking for 6 months. They haven't found anybody and they're desperate. You should apply for the gig. And it just hit me at the right moment. I was like, well, this guy is not letting me really run the place. And I put a tape together. I sort of looked at some playlists and I put a tape together. It was a very eclectic show at the time with a little bit of world music, a little bit of jazz, which I didn't really know that much about. But I was like, I can mix this up. So I put a tape together. I spliced an old interview in that I'd done with Graham Parker, who lived up in the Woodstock area. He was one of those guys, along with Jules Shear and Marshall Crenshaw, who would always show up and do fundraising shows for us.
Right.
Great guys who lived in the Catskills. So I got an interview with Graham, and I cut it into this demo. I sent it off just really because, like, fuck them. I'm going to do this. I had no intention of moving to Los Angeles. I mean, really.
Had you been there? Do you know anything about it? Did you know anything about it?
Ironically enough, I'd been here about 4 months before. There was a Gavin convention in San Diego. And I'd been down to that.
Oh, that one.
Yeah. And I'd spent it was the big monsoon year,
El Nino.
El Nino year, yeah.
It was that massive.
I remember
El
it well,
Nino.
98.
That was the last one.
Beginning, my daughter was born.
The beginning of 98. And so I'd spent a little bit of time in LA and I was like, God, that's nowhere I ever want to live. I'd always thought I'd end up in, you know, I had aspirations bigger than Woodstock or Poughkeepsie, which was the market.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know, New York, you know, I'd applied for a couple of gigs in New York, come close, not happened. I thought maybe Boston. I kind of liked the Northeast, to be honest with you. But then I sent this tape and literally a week later, I was on the air auditioning. And I knew they were going to give me the gig the day after, you know, after the first thing, because I could just see relieved faces.
Who had the show before you? The weird thing is
I remember. Was it Jason Bentley?
He came after me. Chris Doritos.
Chris Doritos.
Oh, Doritos, yes.
Yeah.
Right. That's right. Chris Doritos had bailed.
So for people that may not be aware of KCRW, and some people aren't, it's a non-com, the most famous non-com in the country, in L.A., and everybody that works there tends to then one day become a music supervisor. And you've seen all of these names on movies all the time.
They're all music supervisors at the same time that they're working there. They don't necessarily tend
which is
to
so
become.
Bizarre. That's not a problem. That wasn't a problem for anybody there in management. I guess not.
Well,
you can do whatever you want.
Things have shifted a little bit since then, obviously, because the radio world has shifted a lot. But at the time, there was no Pandora, there was no Spotify, there was not a lot of options, let's be quite frank, in LA for music other than what was on the radio. And the thing about KCRW and Morning Becomes Eclectic, which was the morning show 9 till noon, in the afternoon they were all news and current affairs, they'd go back to music at night, but from 9 till noon in the morning, if you had any interest in anything cool music-wise, you were listening to Morning Becomes Eclectic.
Exactly.
With Chris, before Chris, with Tom, with me.
Which Tom?
Tom Schnabel.
Tom Schnabel.
Right. Who kind of brought world music into the frame here in the States. But you listened to that show, not so much after I left, not because I left, but because the world had shifted. But at the time, all the movers and shakers were listening. So if you're a music supervisor, or if you're a producer, a director, a writer, the creative community was listening, and I was shocked to find songs that I was playing suddenly showing up in car commercials and suddenly showing up on TV shows, and it was because they were listening to the show. Now, we had some great people on at the weekend and overnights as well, and a lot of these people got hired to be music supervisors because they had access to all the cool new stuff. So that's kind of how
yes,
it happened.
And when did they let you into the club? Because they did let you into the music supervisory club, Igby Goes Down.
I've done a couple of things in that world, and I'm really lucky that I did Igby Goes Down because it's a great little flick.
It is a great little flick.
And it was the first thing that I did, so I called in all the favors I could possibly call in. And ended up getting, you know, Coldplay songs and Travis songs and Dandy Warhol songs. This is like 2001, 2002, when all that cool stuff was being made. And got them for pretty good prices for the movie. So I got let in to do that, and it was fun. And I've done a couple of other things. But I'll be honest with you, I found that job not something that I particularly wanted to do, because I had a couple of really positive experiences, like Igby, and then I had a couple of really negative experiences.
Tell us why. Why was it negative? What is it that a music supervisor does that is so stressful? I mean, I understand you're not just, they don't just throw you in a room and go, here, figure out the music for the movie, right? You have to work with all these different people.
It depends on what you're doing. Obviously, television and movies are a different kettle of fish, and I've done both. But in general, I think what I found that I didn't particularly like about it was that there's a lot of opinions. And around about the time that I was beginning to work in that arena was also the time that everybody was getting an iPod. And I would find that as I was talking to a director of a movie, he was getting suggestions from his interns and his assistants and pretty much everybody. And as somebody said to me, you know, everybody's got an iPod and everyone's got an opinion about music. Not everyone has got a Panaflex camera. Right. So no one's coming into him and saying, you should do this shot. I think that's the shot you should do. But everybody's throwing ideas of music. And the bottom line as a music supervisor is, unless the guy who has hired you, be it a showrunner on a television program or a director on a feature, exclusively wants you and gets you and has hired you because of what you can do, it can get really kind of weird. And I, you know, I'm not going to name a movie, but
do you work closely with, who do you work closest with on this thing? Is it the director because it's that person's vision?
On movies, yes.
On movies?
Yeah.
Yeah.
On television, you start working with directors are not really that involved once they've shot the shows, to be honest with you, on TV. They're on to the next one. But you work with editors at the beginning who are doing assemblies as they're putting together the first cut of something. Mm. You know, I worked on the first season of the reboot of 90210, and that was actually a lot of fun because the guys who hired me to do what I do, and I worked with a couple of editors who were really smart music-wise as well. And between us, we would sort of sit in there and we'd look at the music and I'd give them ideas and they'd cut stuff. I would give them a whole bunch of stuff so that when they were doing their first assembly, they'd start slotting stuff in if they felt that it worked. And then you would go through a process of sitting with a producer who would then be like, you know, well, maybe that doesn't work. Can you find us something for here? And you'd go in with a half a dozen songs and you'd sit there with those guys until you got it to the point where they would then send it off to the studio, who would then give their notes, and then maybe you'd have to change something and come back with something, and then it would go to the network, and maybe there were notes from
them.
And
you have to have a lot of patience for all that, because you know that it's a process, okay? So it's like, all right, here's my choice for this, and now you have to sort of massage it through the system to get it to where it needs to be.
The seven systems, like as he's saying, it's like this guy, then that guy, then
right,
that guy,
right,
and
right.
Then it comes down to, is the band going to let you use it? How
well,
much?
If you're good at your job, you should know before you start pitching something for that slot whether or not it's available.
But sometimes if it takes, I've heard horror stories from bands who go, hey, they want to use our song. And their band's like, yeah, this is great. And all of a sudden they go, yeah, but it's gratis. We're not going to pay you anything. And then people are like, what the, you know, like what is the point of, you know, they'll come along after, you know, 6 months of like, we're going to do this or not going to do this. And then it fits perfectly and it'll be a great exposure. As I always say,
it all depends on what it is. You know,
die of exposure.
I had a job for MTV for a year, which is a whole other story, as their music supervisor in residence. Yes, I'm using air quotes.
Yeah. Who did you talk to there? Who was your...
My boss was a guy called Joe Cuello, who was head of music over there, who was great. But, you know, a lot of chefs in the kitchen, so to speak.
Did you talk to Tom Calderon a lot when he was there?
I don't think Tom was there when I was there.
No, that's right. He got there in 97, 98.
Yeah, he was gone by the time I was
there. Bring you back to the music.
But what I was going to say...
The frustrating part, after a while, is, as you say, everybody has an opinion about music.
Well, what I was going to say about MTV was they had no budgets, right? So that's when the gratis stuff starts coming in, where they're like, you know, okay, well, we don't really have any money, but, you know, I mean, we'll use it and we'll talk about it and it'll be there and you'll
and
get your residual
Chiron
payments.
Up and all
yeah,
that
all, that,
of,
all
yeah.
that crap. And, you know, that's how you cram 30 songs into a 30-minute show with a $15,000 budget, you know, and that's... You're not really serving anybody very well with that. You're not serving the musicians well, that's for sure.
Right.
And in many cases, not the stories, because you're just looking for cheap shit.
I'm imagining that the stress point, and correct me if I'm wrong, would be that where it's not such a happy work experience is the people are questioning your decisions, right? They go, why did you make this choice, Nick? I don't think it works like this. And then you have to justify your choices.
Yeah, I don't know as most of those...
Right, which is a pain in the ass.
I don't
right?
know as most of those questions came with that much thought behind them, to
yeah,
be honest
yeah.
with you. It was usually like, I don't like this, give me something else, you know? So I worked on this one show at MTV, and the guy who was the showrunner tortured me for the entire run because he'd been given the cool guy. They're like, hey, here's the cool guy. He's going to be your music supervisor. He's like, no, I'm cooler than him. So the whole process, every episode for 13 episodes, was torture because I would give this guy 20 songs to play in the background in a bar scene. It's throwaway shit. And he'd be like, I don't like those. Give me some more. So you know,
and the ironic thing is, as you know now, you watch these things. 99% of the people aren't out there trying to Shazam. Even you know, back then there was no Shazam to go like, oh my god, that song is perfect in the background because nobody fucking even notices that.
You
shit.
Can't even hear it in the background.
Right.
Exactly.
Or it's out of phase and it's like the band's on stage and they're badly lip syncing to it.
So that was the moment, to be quite frank with you, where I was like, I don't think I really want to do this, you know? And it was never like, oh, I'm going to be a music supervisor because that's not really what I wanted to do with my life. But, you know, you can make a living, maybe. I mean, there are a couple of guys from KCIW who've done very well. And that's their gig. That's how they make a job and they have a, you know, part-time radio
gig. By the way,
gig.
Does anybody know how much those pay? Like the big movies, like who's on... Avengers Infinity War, somebody famous from KCRW, I forget who it was.
Don't know, let's look it
who's
up.
Who's done a lot of these things. The money must be outrageous after a certain amount of time when you become, if you're attached to a really huge movie.
That really depends.
It depends. You know,
it really depends on a
Do you know,
million
Nick,
things.
What the money range is? Do you have any idea what, you know, even just off the top of your head, what a music supervisor might make on a really big movie? Is it a million? Is it 2 million?
No. I would say it's, you know, anywhere between, you know, 50 and 150 grand.
Depends, you get a few of those a year,
depends,
you're doing okay.
Depends on what it is. But the guys who are doing movies usually are just doing movies. There is that distinction. You have a lot of guys, or women for that matter, and there's a couple of female DJs from over at KCRW who do very well at this, who are, you know, music supervising 7 TV shows at any given time. But they'll have a staff of people to help them because you can't possibly do that. But shows get canceled, even though the world has changed and we have streaming now. So at least now you'll get to do the 13 episodes. I mean, I worked on shows that you'd work on a pilot for months and then maybe it got picked up and then you're on for the first 13 shows and then it gets canceled after 3. You know, at least now with the streaming.
And you've already selected for 13 because obviously they've shot 13 or they've only shot 3?
Usually when a show got canceled, like a network show, and I'm sure it's still the same now, they're usually a couple of episodes ahead. So if they decide they're going to kill it after 4 episodes, they might have 6 done.
Right.
Right. So it's not so much that you've got them done. It's just that you're getting paid however much it is per episode. Well, and they kill the show after 3 episodes. And you're thinking, oh, well, I'm going to make $3,500, you know, for each show for the next 12 episodes. And you're budgeting your life around that. And then they're like, oh, no, we're done with that. And you're scrambling for another one. So the people who are doing TV, they're constantly looking for new gigs. I mean, I know one guy right now who did a ton of TV shows, had all the cool TV shows, and all of a sudden he's got 1.
Right.
So, you know.
Well,
yeah.
While you're looking that up, what was he looking up again?
Music supervisor for the Avengers.
The Avengers.
So while you're looking that up, an old friend of mine from San Diego who started as a guy who got signed to Virgin Records in this band called The Origin, ended up becoming one of the most key players in the business. Michael Andrews, you know Michael.
Yeah.
Michael Andrews because he happened to be in the right place at the right time, and Jake Kasdan.
Jake Kasdan did Grand Canyon, Freaks and Geeks.
I mean, Freaks and Geeks was the start for Michael. He was doing all the incidental music.
Right.
And then he was writing original songs, and he was in the thing as the like a band leader or something. But he ended up doing everything from Donnie Darko. That's kind of what launched his career, was doing Donnie Darko. It was a great story because obviously you know the Tears for Fears guys. But Michael was trying to get the clearance to put Mad World, the original version, in Donnie Darko, and Tears for Fears said, nope, not going to do it. So he went and did his own version.
With Gary.
With Gary Jules. Yep. Put it in the film. And it was that year that that song went to number one, when the other film that was huge in England, I can't remember what the name of the movie was, their song in the film was supposed to go to number one at Christmas. It was like...
It did.
Well, no. The Michael Andrews song went to number one.
Yeah.
The other film. There was a film about songs going to number one at Christmas.
Okay.
And I can't remember...
The thing with Hugh Grant or whatever
Grant,
it is.
Hugh Grant, yes.
It was like Love Actually? Maybe, yeah. Is that the one where they're talking about the Christmas single?
Yeah, where Bill Nye is the old rock star and he changes the whole
presentation of the movie was, we're going to have this number one at Christmas.
I like your accent there, mate.
And it's like, bloody hell, mate. Yeah. Fucking hell.
And Gary Jules, I mean, Mike Andrews, obviously, but Gary was the guy who got the attention. And I have to say this whenever anybody asks me about it. I remember Mike Andrews calling me one day and saying, why do you make a point of not saying my name when you talk about this song? And I'm like, you know, I'm really not. And
that's the way the record was released.
That's the way it was released. And I will quite happily from now on make sure I say Gary Jules with Mike
what
Andrews.
What were you saying? What were you saying?
Gary Jules.
Oh, okay.
Gary Jules. Because Gary was the singer. Michael did the track. It was part of the soundtrack. But nobody was putting who the band was.
But Mike did it and arranged it and called Gary in and said, hey, do you want to sing this? So I understood where he was coming from. But that song became number one.
Number one in England to beat the movie. But here's the crazy thing. Yeah. The reason he picked it was because Mad World was one of the first songs that 91X played.
Yes.
It was drilled into their heads, those two guys, when they were growing up in San Diego. So they're like, oh, this would be perfect for Donnie Darko. Tears for Fears says no. So now what Tears for Fears does when they play the song live, they play like an amalgamation of Michael's arrangement into their own arrangement.
That's right. By the way, the guy who looks like he does all the Marvel big movies is a guy called Dave Jordan, who's not a radio.
He was not a radio. Yeah,
I'm sure he's got a nice
Jordan.
Nice house somewhere. Anyway,
probably
music supervision. It's fun. I guess at times, and at other times it's not. And for me, I had the. The very, I mean, look, I look at it this way. I mean, anytime I'm working and somebody's paying me to do something, I'm a lucky guy. And if I get to be involved with something that's cool, then I'm even luckier. So the fact that I had the opportunity to work on Igby and a couple of other things that I'm proud of, I'm really lucky.
Which ones are those? What else are you proud of?
The things I'm proud of? I'm proud of working on the TV show, 90210, because we did some great stuff. And we put Adele in there and a bunch of cool music before it broke. I'm proud of working on another TV show, my first TV show, which was called Life as We Know It, which didn't make it beyond 13 episodes. But that was for the same guys who did 90210. And I'm proud of working on Ben Affleck's first feature, a movie called Gone Baby Gone, where we didn't put that many songs into
it. Oh, that was you? Yeah, yeah. But good movie.
But the songs that we put into it were, you know, really, really helped, I guess, tell the story.
Let me ask you this. Do you sit there sometimes when you're coming up with these concerts, do you throw in some of your favorite songs that should have been hits years and years and years ago because you know that that song should have been a massive hit, but never was because it didn't get the airplay, to see if you can actually spark it so they can do something else?
There are certain songs that I have tried to place in television shows and movies over the years that I haven't been able to, that I still would love to find a place
for. Give me a couple of examples.
Yeah, give us the list, because we can probably help with that. Maybe we can get them.
we'll play them on our podcast.
We'll play them on the podcast.
So give me an idea of like what are some of the songs that... That you would sit there and go, like, this song should have been a massive hit.
By the way, while he's looking for those
songs. Yeah, thank you, because there's one in particular that I can think of right now.
The reason we're here is because he's got a stash of unreleased Dandy Warhol's tunes that I want to get a hold of.
I do?
He does.
Okay.
He's holding out. You probably have the new album, right?
I'm sure it's been released already.
I don't have the new
album.
I'm a big fan of the band as well.
I know that Nick is an even bigger fan of the band.
And interestingly enough, I talked about getting sober, right?
Right.
Well, I was sober for a long time, and then I wasn't for a while. I am sober again now, thankfully. Everybody's happy about that. But in the intervening time where I had a slip, as they call it,
yeah,
and you know, managed to destroy pretty much everything around me, because that's what happens. I did spend a night in Portland with the Dandy Warhols.
Oh my God! And you lived
was
to tell
about slip?
It.
Was that the slip? Was that the slip, or was that
that wasn't the slip? The slip was an 8-year slip, but
that must have been interesting. I can only imagine what that night must have been like.
In the middle of it, and I'd known them for years,
yeah,
and spent many times with them trying to get them sober enough to perform.
Right.
On you know, various radio shows. And we did one session over at the Village that we could never use. It was that bad.
Really?
It was so fucked up. But I ended up one night in Portland, supposedly going to do a session with them in the auditorium, which is the studio that they very wisely built with the money from the Motorola commercial in Europe. Let's just say it was a very long, late night, early morning.
Of course.
The sun came up. I never get over when I see footage of the European festivals, you know, the big ones like Reading or whatever it is, where, when they perform, they
that's
do
not
Bohemian.
European, that's English.
English. Whenever they do Bohemian Like You, the crowd goes absolutely bananas. Like you would never see that in this country. Only there would you see 200,000 people.
They go plantains people over there.
It's a hit. I mean, that is a hit.
Massive.
That song is a massive, massive hit.
And the strange part about it, doesn't sound like they wrote it. It sounds like it was written by somebody in the 70s, hid it away someplace, and suddenly...
I think the great thing about Courtney is that, you know, he understands how to use his influences. You know, he really does. So, I mean, you can hear the Beatles and the Stones, but not like a ripoff. You can just hear his influences. And that song is a smash. It just never really happened here. But as you said, in Europe, they go
nuts. Yeah, and I wonder why it was never huge here. But the time may have passed, too.
And we did put that in
what year did that come out? What year did that come out?
I think it came out in 2000, maybe.
I don't remember.
2000, 2001. The movie came out in... because I remember, you know, we were supposed to do my first meeting on that movie on 9/11. That was the day we were supposed to have the meeting on sitting down with the director, Burr Steers, and his editor, a guy called Pat, I can't remember his last name, McKinley.
Oh, I remember. I think they were on Capitol. Weren't they on Capitol?
They were on Capitol.
Capitol didn't know what to do with the band.
Yeah,
it was
Capitol
another one of those like Gary Gersh things. And
2001.
What do we do?
2001, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I was texting with him the other day. He's a great guy, and I love those guys. There's one sober member in that band, by the way. I don't know how. Peter.
Really?
I don't know how he manages it, but well done.
That's insane.
I love that band.
But the one song that I have tried to put in stuff that I've never been able to came out in 2001 as well. It's by a guy called Matthew J, who unfortunately passed away a couple of years after it. And it was a song that I think is well worth looking up. It's called Let Your Shoulder Fall. Beautiful song. I'll find a place for it.
Yeah.
In my own movie. Seeing as I don't do
the movie
music.
Of your life, and
don't
you,
do music
you will be played
anymore.
By. I'm not sure who you'll be played by, not Halloran, not me, but
well, he can play the old me.
All right. So how many years? So you spent the formative years for a lot of people at KCRW. Was it like 10 years or?
Well,
how long was it?
The formative years of what? Of my life, my career.
Of a lot of people in LA who know nothing but
name. When you became the legend that you are today.
And you did become legendary.
Because of your influence on all things Los Angeles, which they didn't really have.
I was very lucky that I had that gig at the time that I had it. And
I think you brought something to that show that was not there, and it might have been just the English accent.
You
sound very authoritative.
Well, I'll tell
when
you
when it's you and not Tom Schnabel.
I'll tell you what it was. It was a commercial sensibility that they hadn't had before. And I had come from commercial radio, although I'd grown up listening to public broadcasters, obviously. And I think, you know, coming from Woodstock or Poughkeepsie, where we had to scrap for everything, you know, I mean, we were always fighting for market share, for shows. You know, like there's a huge classic rock station in Poughkeepsie, WPDH, Poughkeepsie.
That's right.
You know, they're a powerhouse. I mean, that station, Spin did many years ago, an article on the example of the classic rock station in America, and it was PDH, and they were the giant, the gorilla, and they were playing classic rock, of course, but they were massive, and we were sort of trying to play like, you know, modern rock into that marketplace. So we had to fight for everything, and you know, promotions and all that kind of stuff. So when I came to LA and I went into the basement, which is where they were at the time, they've now moved into a brand new facility, but you know, we're in a basement studio in Santa Monica College, it was kind of like a little snotty, you know. They looked at me coming in and they're like, who the fuck are you?
Right. You're not in the club yet.
You talk about moves, right? I came from Market 157 to Market 2. And everybody in Los Angeles with a record collection had applied for that gig, including every jock. So when I walked in, they were like, who the fuck are you? And it was a little nerve-wracking, to be honest with you. But what I said was, well, I'm the guy who got the gig. So if anybody doesn't want to be around, let us know now. Otherwise, I'll meet with you all independently and we'll find out how we're going to do this. And, you know, I did my first pledge drive. And once they saw that the numbers were there, because in non-com radio, as you guys know, it's all about the money you bring in a pledge drive. And I could see, I think I'd been there maybe, I got there in April, and I think they did a drive a couple of months later, and I maintained what the previous guy had done. And then they were like, okay, we can breathe. And then everybody shut the fuck up.
You know? Back when I went to Indy, 103?
103.1,
I'm bad with
that. I came to you for a job there right before you got bounced.
Before I got bounced?
Don't you remember? Christ. We had lunch somewhere.
Yes,
that's like,
right.
I was like, so I'm jumping out of here. How about the morning show? And you're like, yeah, that sounds interesting. I followed up like 2 weeks later. He was gone.
Yeah. Oh, my God. And what was interesting during that time, because this was like 04, 05, 06, when you looked at the ratings, here's the thing about KCRW. Its reputation far exceeded its ratings, its numbers in the market. Now, it had a huge reputation within the market, one that was like you couldn't believe the numbers were this low for a station that had this much recognition.
You are presuming that the people meter is an accurate device.
No, this is before the people meter, pre-people meter.
I don't know.
Okay, so pre-people meter, you look at the numbers. KCRW had okay numbers, somewhere in the twos.
We did pretty good when I was there.
But KPCC was kicking its ass. And people didn't talk about that.
Yeah, but when KPCC has the best signal in Los Angeles.
I don't think they have a better signal than KCRW.
I don't think so either.
You don't think so?
No.
I don't think so. But
I'm going to look that up, gentlemen.
But what they do have is they have 24/7 news and current affairs. And what they've also done really well is create local news programming as well. And if you want to hear news in LA and you want to hear real news, that's the place to go.
But
they've done it very, very well.
Sort of. Because we're all in the radio, I'm a little critical. That guy in the morning, what's his name? Larry Mantle?
He's a legend.
Yeah, he's a legend in his own lunchtime, as you like to say.
Raises a ton of money.
I'm sure he does, but his voice is he's so annoying. You know, Tammy, my wife, thought that he was a woman for the first, like, 3 weeks that we heard the show, because I was listening to it all the time.
Tiny Tammy.
And I said to Tammy, she goes, who is that woman? I go, that's a guy. His name is Larry Mantle. She goes, he sounds like a woman.
I love
and
Larry.
I don't. I think it's terrible. I think his follow-up is awful.
He's been there a long time.
I know, but they don't. The whole station needs like somebody to come in and
they
shake
need me
them
and
by
you
the, yeah.
and Halloran.
But they need
I
somebody
take,
to
I
go,
take that back.
Here's
They've got
how
600
you,
watts, by the way.
Yeah.
But they're up at 2,900 feet.
They could be better.
Listen next week as Max and Halloran continue their conversation with Nick Harcourt in part two of Full Hardcore Press on The Oddcast.
Slam the door.